So that's Hebrews chapter 12, and we'll read the first 13 verses. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And have you completely forgotten this word of encouragement that addresses you as a father addresses his son? It says, "My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. Do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines the one he loves, and he chastens everyone he accepts as his son." Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as his children. For what children are not disciplined by their father? If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are not legitimate, not true sons and daughters at all. Moreover, we have all had fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of spirits and live? They disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good, in order that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Therefore, strengthen your feeble arms and weak knees. Make level paths for your feet, so that the lame may not be disabled, but rather healed. Amen.
Lord, thank you just so much for this opportunity to meet. Thank you for your word. Thank you that we can come here and hear you speak into our lives. And I pray that we take it and apply it to our lives. I pray that you are continually transforming us and changing us to be more like your son, Jesus. We ask this humbly in his name. Amen. If you looked on the handout, there's two things. Firstly, you might see that the reading was Daniel. Actually, it's from Hebrews, so hopefully you picked up that. And secondly, you might have noticed that the talk was entitled True Grit. You might be thinking, what the heck does that mean? Well, if you're cultured, you'll know that this is actually the title of a film. Two films, actually. One from 1969 and another one which was a remake of that from 2009. Just in terms of a recap of the plot, True Grit is about a young girl, a girl called Matty. She's 14, it's an old sort of country western film. And her father is killed by an outlaw, a guy called Tom Shaney. Anyway, Maddie is smart, she's determined, and she has a lot of money. So she decides she's going to actually hire a hired gun to go and bring Tom Shaney to justice. And she does that. And she could choose any number of hired guns. In the Wild West, apparently this was common practice, you could do this. But she chooses one guy in particular, a washed-up, sort of drunkard guy called Rooster. He's actually described in the film as an old fat man with one eye. They say that at several occasions. And she chooses him for one reason. She says that he has, well, she's heard that he has true grit, resilience, toughness, mental endurance. And so she picks him. And so they set out on this trek. They're joined by a Texas Ranger, whose job it is to actually track down Tom Shaney as well. And they set out on this trek to try and get Tom Shaney to justice. And it's amazing how the film actually explores this idea of grit. What does it even mean? Because at the start, it's a bit of a joke. Rooster actually laughs when he hears the phrase. He thinks it's absurd. It's a silly phrase. But the film progresses and it actually looks at what true grit means. Who actually has it? Who has true grit? Who has endurance? Is it this guy, the Texas Ranger? Well, the film shows probably not. You know, he's shown to be pompous and self-righteous and kind of annoying. He doesn't actually achieve much at all. Is it Tom Shaney? If you've seen the film, you know that he sort of hangs this dark presence over the story, like looming, and he's sort of bigger up. Then you meet him, and he's kind of petty and small and cowardly. Tim Rooster, the only character who is described as having true grit, is a bit of a drunkard. He sits there and rambles and mumbles throughout the whole film. You don't really know what he's doing. He's occasionally effective, but generally not. Actually, the one who has true grit is Maddie, the young girl. Her father has just been killed, and yet she goes on. And she's on this quest, and the others want to turn back, and she presses on. Even at the end of the film, she's poisoned by a snake, which paralyzes her for the rest of her life. And yet she endures. And so this thing, which starts off as a bit of a joke at the start of the movie, by the end of the film, is shown to be found in the most unlikely of places: endurance, resilience, true grit. And I wonder if it's not that different for us in church, because we can talk about resilience within this situation so easily, can't we? Within a Bible study, within just conversations, oh yeah, this person has endurance, they have resilience, and the Bible talks about it a fair bit. But it's kind of theoretical. It's not until we actually live it out, until we actually pay for it with grief and endurance and suffering, that we actually see what resilience is all about. And this is what this passage is talking about this morning. Run your path with perseverance, true grit, endurance. How do we actually get it? Well, the writer of Hebrews, and it's written by a guy, not many people know who wrote it, but they think it might be Apollos or Paul, they're not really sure. But he gives us some really, really practical ideas, really sort of things that we can actually do to actually get true grit. Endurance, perseverance. So the first thing I want to emphasize is that we strive, an active word, strive for solidarity. We strive for solidarity. What the heck does that mean? Let me explain. Verse 1 of the reading that John read out. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. Okay? Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. You might be thinking, what is he talking about there? Well, it might pay for us to actually understand a little bit of what Hebrews is about. We're actually preaching through Hebrews in the night, but we won't be doing that in the morning, so it's not going to hurt if we actually do a bit of a recount here. Hebrews is written for a very specific situation, a very specific circumstance. It was written to a community of Christians who come from a very conservative, orthodox, Jewish background. Okay? And the writer of Hebrews is worried that they're going to actually turn back to Judaism. So they're Christians, but through persecution, through suffering, through different trials of different times, of different kinds, they're being tempted to go back and become Jews again. And it even seems to hint that a lot of Jews were being killed, sorry, a lot of Jewish Christians were being killed in this way by Jewish authorities. And so as you read through Hebrews, you're going to see how the writer builds this case that Judaism has a value and a worth. It's important, but it actually ultimately points to Jesus. It always points to Jesus. And so as you read through, you're going to see all these sort of Jewish motifs, so ideas of covenant, of land, you're going to see ideas of temple and sacrifice, and even the whole priestly system. And the writer makes clear how they all point to Jesus. And chapter 11 is almost like the crescendo of his argument, because it talks about these incredibly important figures of Jewish history and how they're united by one thing, by faith. If you read through chapter 11, it just goes on and on and on about this idea, by faith. So it talks about Moses, how he did what he did by faith. Abraham, by faith. Isaac, Jacob, Daniel, they acted by faith. And his point is quite clear. They had faith in the saving work of God to redeem them from their situation, and yet we as Christians actually see that materialise in the person of Jesus. And so we're all part of the same sort of body. We're all part of the same thing. Now this would have had two effects. If you're an ancient Jew, this would have been so offensive for you. Because remember, it was the Jews who were persecuting the Christians. This would have been bordering on blasphemy. To say that Moses, well, he was kind of believing in the same thing that the Christians believe. But if you're a new Christian, converted from Judaism, this would have been so encouraging. Why? Because there's like a line of continuity, isn't there? There's a solidarity between what came before and what was being lived and breathed and experienced then. And the thing that unites everyone is faith in Jesus, whether explicitly or not. And so it would have been so encouraging. Inflammatory for a Jew, encouraging for a Christian. And so the idea of solidarity. And even with Christians who are suffering, in verse 38 of chapter 11, it says this, those who the world was not worthy. These were Christians who had been killed by Jewish authorities. Okay, solidarity. They're being united in faith. Followers in God from the ancient days, as well as modern contemporary followers of God in the first century. Now sometimes in the modern context, we don't really understand what all these sorts of things are sort of pushing at. I had a conversation with a guy just this week, actually. I was playing at a conference, and this guy was a Christian, but he came from a Jewish background. It was really interesting to talk to him. He has a really different perspective than maybe someone from our situation comes from. And he was saying that we in the West underestimate how emotionally important and how culturally significant the Jewish faith is for someone who calls themselves a Jew. He comes from that background, and he said something astounding to me. He said that even in modern Sydney in 2016, it's very common for people to go to synagogue, who are Jews, every Saturday, even though they don't believe in God. They have no faith. They think these sort of narratives in the Old Testament are just sort of stories, parables, fables. Yet they go to synagogue every week. And he said, we underestimate the kind of cultural and emotional ties that this actually places on the heart of a Jew. And that's in 2016. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. Obviously, when people are in a different sort of ethnic group, they galvanize around one another, don't they? And particularly if we consider some of the history of last century. You understand why the Jews would forge a really tight people. But this is in 2016. Imagine how much stronger that would have been in the first century. It's powerful, isn't it? History is powerful. Tradition is powerful. And I love the way the writer of Hebrews presents it. He upholds the Jewish tradition. There's also a bit of a critique in there as well. Ultimately, the value of the Jewish tradition, the Jewish history, was that it pointed, and was the story of God's revelation pointing to Jesus. And sometimes I think that we have our own value and our own tradition, our own history. I spoke about this at length last week, so I'm not going to go on for too long. But ultimately, the thing that unites us is not culture or tradition or history, it's our faith in Jesus. I remember when this building, or this church rather, was in the building up there where the Thai sort of restaurant is. I'm sure there's people here who remember before that. I remember that building up there. There might be people who remember two buildings before that. I only remember vague images and bits and pieces. We have a really vibrant history here at church, don't we? 1895 we were founded. Our history is so important. But I wonder if we could take a leaf out of the writer of Hebrews' book and just sort of validate our history and look at the important things and the valuable things about it, but also hold to it kind of loosely. The thing that united us, the thing that drove us, even in 1895, was our faith in Jesus. You see, that actually allows us to be less rigid about the things that are happening. It doesn't make us actually hold on to the past. It doesn't allow us to hold on to the past. We're united by faith, solidarity. That's how we have the endurance to persevere and change and move forward. First thing. Second thing, throw off sin. Read on the second half of the very first verse of chapter 12. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. Notice the active... Oh, sorry, that's my notes there. Okay, so I'll just say that again. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. I love the way he writes this. You know, there's a sort of understanding of how easily sin brings us down. I'm reminded as I read this of, like, you know, you're swimming through a lake, maybe even the ancient Sea of Galilee, and there's reeds and things at the bottom trying to tangle your feet and pull you down. And that's the reality of living in sin in this world, isn't it? Okay, the sin that so easily entangles. But look what he says a little bit ahead in verse 4. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. Really interesting phrase. A few different ideas about what he's saying here. Some people think that he's actually referring to like an ancient sort of phrase or saying. It's likely that he was referring to some sort of violent sport, like ancient boxing or maybe even like gladiatorial combat. They're not really sure. But where even if you get a cut or you wound or draw blood somehow, you keep going. Okay? That's what he seemed to be learning, but he's using this in terms of a spiritual application. So you need to resist sin even to the point of sacrifice and pain. Even to the point where it causes you discomfort, is his point. And so sin easily entangles us, without a doubt. But our resistance to it needs to be strong, it needs to be staunch, it needs to be hard. Now, I don't know how you feel about this, but I find this really, really hard. What sin do you struggle with? What sort of things are you aware of that you consistently and repeatedly fall? It could be gossip, it could be slander. Could be that sort of emotional kick we get when we see someone who maybe struggles in life a little bit. You know, we sort of get that, you know, at least I'm sort of more together than that person. It might be lust, it might be stuff that's on TV or things online. If you're anything like me, it sometimes feels like it's two steps forward and three steps back. Did I get that right? One step forward, two steps back. You know what I'm trying to say, hopefully. It's just this struggle. And I often think that Christian faith is at times the easiest thing and then the most difficult thing in the world. What do I mean by that? Well, We're saved by faith. We just have to accept what Jesus has done for us. But as soon as we become a Christian, we have to start to deal with the evil within us. And it's hard. And the victory sometimes seems so small. And perhaps on one occasion you do resist the sin. Perhaps you don't mouth off at the guy who cuts you off on the street. Perhaps you don't get angry. But sometimes the thoughts are there. Two steps forward, one step back. You know what I'm trying to say. But I wonder if it's just that struggle that actually changes us and renews us. It drives us to the cross of Christ. I wonder if it's that pushing forward, even though sometimes we feel the failures. Sometimes we feel just the frailty of our ability to actually be obedient. Pushing ahead, even though we fail. And it sometimes makes us realize that actually we don't have it all together. Actually, we're much more weaker than sometimes we realize. That struggle, that pushing forward. Don't want to sound like a pretentious goober, but this idea of this kind of this existential tension. We don't sit there and be satisfied with where we are. We keep pushing forward, even though sometimes we fail and we fail and we fail, even to the point of drawing blood, the writer of Hebrews would remind us. Jesus describes Christian faith, following him, being discipled as a Christian, in two ways. He describes it as the yoke that brings rest and as also as picking up your cross. And it's in that tension that we walk every day, don't we? Pushing forward through sin. I go to a gym out at Tarrant Point. It's called Tribe. It's a wonderful gym, probably the best gym I've been attached to. If you ever join the gym, mention my name or Heath's name because we get a discount that way. I'm kind of serious there. We get a big discount. It's not the most cheap gym. But I got some sessions with a trainer at one stage. Really great guy. Young guy, probably about 25. Bit of one of these gym junkie guys, but really, really wonderful guy. And he said, you should never, ever be comfortable in the gym. If you go to the gym and you cruise, and you're doing weights, and you're sort of like, yeah, I can do that, that's all right. And you're not working up a sweat. And you're actually not doing the job you're supposed to be doing. And they have classes, and they change the classes every month. Because the idea is your body actually adjusts every month, and they need to keep changing things because your body can't be comfortable. It's not a bad analogy for the Christian life, is it? If you're ever comfortable, then maybe something's wrong. You've ever looked at something and struggled with something and you keep falling into sin, but then you sort of look back over the last couple of years and said, actually, I've really grown in that. It's because of that struggle, that continually pushing forward, the sin that so easily entangles, but that we're supposed to resist. And so first thing, strive for solidarity. Secondly, throw off sin. Thirdly, submit to the discipline, submit to circumstances in our life. One's a bit tricky, so let's read. Verse 5, second half of verse 5. My son, talking about basically an Old Testament passage here, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. Do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines the one he loves. And he chastens everyone he accepts as a son. And verse 7, endure hardship as discipline. This is an outrageous claim. He's making clear that every difficult thing in our life, every trial, every hardship, to use his word, is a discipline. It's the hand of God. Now, I was trying to rack my brain. Discipline's not a positive sort of word. We don't generally think of discipline in a positive way. I was trying to rack my brain of situations in which I have been disciplined by my parents or by teachers, and I couldn't for the life of me think of an example. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm a wonderful kid. I don't know if I was. It just means I can't remember. Now, I think my dad's here somewhere. I don't know where he is. I'm sure he can remember examples of where I was disobedient, unpleasant young kid. I just can't remember them. So I'm sure they're out there. But I remember being disciplined at different times for different things, and I never, ever enjoyed it. Okay, I never, ever enjoyed it. The truth is, I actually used to become resentful to people who disciplined me. It's almost like, you know, I want to do X, Y, and Z, and I feel like the person who's disciplining me, was being withholding, was being deliberately unpleasant, was being deliberately kind of nasty, trying to deny me a pleasure that I think I deserved or something that I had the right to in my life. The truth is, though, when you look back, you actually see discipline as a positive thing. It's probably good that I didn't get that. It's probably good that that had that consequence. But it's not a positive experience when we're actually going through it. Look what he says in verse 11. No discipline seemed pleasant at the time. No discipline seems pleasant at the time. But painful later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace. Oh, sorry. For those who have been trained by it. And so basically, he's trying to help us to understand the situations and the circumstances in our life, no matter how difficult, as being character-forming, as being character-shaping, as in bringing about the situation of righteousness in our life. Now, we need to be really, really clear here. There are situations in life where difficult things happen, and it might not be because of a sin. Okay? And I also want to be clear that I'm not trying to be dismissive of difficulties and suffering and hardship. I know there's some suffering and examples in this room that I can't even begin to understand. There's examples of hardship that I can never enter into. But there's a big difference between understanding the things, no matter how horrific and horrible in our life, as coming from the hand of a malicious, sort of capricious God, as against coming from the hand of a loving God who's actually trying to achieve things in our life. He's trying to forge things in our character. There's a big difference, and I think that's what he's trying to emphasize here. And the image of a father is a powerful one, isn't it? Now, if you ever know someone who's suffered greatly but suffered well, you see that there's a nature to their character. There's something inside of them, something being forged in their heart that no other situation or circumstances brings about. I don't wonder if it's an attitude towards the one who's handing them and dealing with these things in our life. Do we see God as being harmful, or do we see God as being loving? One writer puts it like this: it's doubtful whether God can bless someone greatly until he has hurt him or her deeply. We've all got scars, don't we? We all suffer. But how do we submit to that? How do we let that work itself in our hearts? It's never pleasant at the time. What is it bringing about in our souls? What is it bringing about inside of our lives? So submit to discipline. Lastly, look to Jesus. Look to Jesus. So I'm going to take us back to verse 2. This is how we get endurance. This is how we get true grit. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. It's a bit of a nebulous sort of command there, isn't it? So look to Jesus, okay, what does that even mean? Well, let's follow on from the actual passage. He's a bit more specific than this. Going on from the verse 2. For the joy before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. What does that mean? For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. I was trying to think of how to explain this, and I'm going to come up with an analogy I have no experience with. I've never had a baby, never been pregnant, never in my life. That might surprise you, hopefully it won't. But I've heard it's an interesting experience. I've heard it's a challenging experience. I've heard it's a very difficult experience. Being pregnant changes your body, changes your hormones. Apparently it can do all sorts of stuff to you. There's a sense in which you sort of do a trade-off, isn't there? You look at the joy of rearing kids, you know, the happiness of actually having a family. And in one sense, you almost scorn the burdens of pregnancy because you can see the greater good of it. You can see the greater joys to come. I wonder if it's a similar sort of idea here. Jesus, even though I don't think he went to the cross willingly, it talks about, well, he did in one sense, but it talks about how he went knowing the pain and the sacrifice and the difficulty that would bring. But it says here that he scorned that shame. Why? Because he saw the value of bringing a redeemed people to himself. Notice again the language. He endured the cross. Notice how that links with the theme that he's talking about? Endurance, perseverance. And yet his suffering is over. Look what it says here. It says that he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. See how that's completed? His work is finished. And there's a contrast with the work that's still happening on us, because we're still in flux, aren't we? We're still being shaped by our circumstances. We're still learning to be faithful as we follow God through our daily experiences. We're still learning to run with perseverance the race marked out for us. But it contrasts with the finished work of God. And that's supposed to bring us incredible security, encouragement. His work is finished. So even though there's so many things in our life that are changing all the time, sometimes in ways that we don't like, his work is completed. It's finished. He's sitting down at the right hand of God. So just to recap, we strive for solidarity. It brings resilience. It brings endurance. We throw off sin. We enter into that struggle, that pushing and falling. We submit to discipline. We submit to the circumstances in our life in hope, in faith and love of the Father. And we look to Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. I'm just going to finish with a story that just happened this week. In terms of looking at Jesus, I played at a conference. It was called LIT, Leaders in Training. It was down at the Anglican Youth Works site, sort of tucked away in the National Park there. It was great, really cool. But you're playing with really, really good musos. You're playing with really, really good musos. It sort of puts a bit of pressure on you because the expectations are really, really high. And that comes about in a whole bunch of ways, but mainly it comes about in just flexibility. They often get a song and they just change the key, or they change the arrangement, or they just drop something else in there, and they just put you on the spot. And the expectation is you're just going to go with it. You're just going to work with it. And so there was one instance where literally, I think it was about a minute before the session, they said, "Tim, we want you to play this song." And I said, "Okay." And I got up there and just sort of fumbled my way through it. They give you the starting note, and you just got to feel your way through it. And because of that, you just feel the expectation. You don't want to stuff up. And there was a few times where I'll admit, I got lost, completely lost. But luckily, they did something a little bit different this year. Normally, they have the words on the screen at the back. You can't really see them. This year, they had the words on two small screens on either side of the platform. And in those times when I was lost, I could just look down and go, "Oh, that's where we are." And I could get a sense of where we were going. I get a sense of the bigger picture. Even though you're floundering, you don't know what's going on, you look to the screen. And it gives you a reference. I wonder if the writer of Hebrews is saying something similar. You look to Jesus. There's so much in our life that makes us swim and be filled with fear and doubt. There's so many things in our life that just involve sacrifice and pain. Often we don't know what we're doing. We're floundering, we're swimming. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. I don't understand the forces without me. I don't understand the forces within me. I struggle with sin. Doesn't seem to be winning. What would the writer of Hebrews say? He would say, "Look to Jesus. Look to Jesus. Look to Jesus." That's how you get true grit. That's how you get resilience. That's how you endure. I'm going to pray. Lord and Heavenly Father, thank you so much for the fact that you are active in our life. Thank you for the fact that you bring about fruit in our hearts. I pray that we can truly gain resilience, true grit. I pray that you use the circumstances in our life to make us men and women of character and of substance, seeing the glory and the goodness and the faithfulness of you even through times of suffering and endurance. I pray that you continually change us to be less tied to our circumstances and to have greater faith in you. And I pray that as a church we can embody this, but I pray individually we can embody this as well. And we ask and pray that you will bring this about in our lives. And we ask this humbly in Jesus' name. Amen.